of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on his birthday, Monday, January 8th. Come ride your bike around Portland with Diablo as we celebrate the life and music of David Bowie with a mobile dance party and sing-along. Again, that's the second annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride at 7 p.m. at the Bowie Bike Lane at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Main on January 8th in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage on the community events.
KBOO Portland. Up next is your Tuesday evening news.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses are sprinkled with dew? How far would I travel to be where you are? How far is the journey from here to a star? And if I ever lost you, how much would I cry? How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky?
Daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Governor Kate Brown appointed Adrienne Nelson to the Oregon Supreme Court, marking the first time an African American has served on the high court since the state's 158-year history.
Authorities are looking for a missing Tualatin man last seen in his kayak near the mouth of the Seaside Estuary.
Some Oregon state lawmakers are determined to make a big push for a program to cap carbon emissions during a 2018 legislative session next month. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 2nd, 2018. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Jasmine Moneymaker. Authorities today are looking for a missing Tualatin man last seen in his kayak near the mouth of the Seaside Estuary. Matthew Manley, 42, last seen crabbing from the recreational vessel, the City of Seaside said in a news release. He was reported missing yesterday afternoon at about 2:45 p.m. Searches from the air, ground, and water have been unsuccessful. Police, fire, and U.S. Coast Guard officials have been involved in the search. The City of Seaside would like to remind those recreating in and around open waters to use extreme caution. Water temperatures can be deadly this time of year, with water temperatures near 50 degrees resulting in hypothermia in a very short amount of time. The city continued saying, quote, "Let someone know if you are planning to be around the water. Please observe proper safety and use a flotation device around the ocean and rivers." The search continues Tuesday, and the city asks anyone who has more information to call Seaside Detective Guy Knight at 503-738-6311.
Oregon made history again today when Governor Kate Brown appointed Adrienne Nelson to the Oregon Supreme Court, marking the first time an African American has served on the high court in the state's 158-year history. No African American judge has ever served on the state's second highest court, the Oregon Court of Appeals before. Nelson, who is in her early 50s, has presided as a Multnomah County Circuit Judge for almost 12 years. During her circuit appointment by then-Governor Ted Kulongski in 2006, she was the only African-American judge in the state court system of about 200 judges. Today there are five, three of whom who were appointed by Governor Brown last year. Nelson fills a vacancy created by retired Justice Jack Landau. Her appointment starts immediately. Nelson grew up in Arkansas. While in high school, her mother sued her school district for refusing to permit an African-American student to be recognized as a valedictorian, according to the governor's office. Nelson's mother prevailed, and Nelson was named valedictorian, the governor's office said. Nelson attended the University of Arkansas and later the University of Texas Law School. She began her career in 1996 as a public defender in Multnomah Defenders Incorporated from 1999 to 2004. She worked at the Portland law firm of Bennett, Hartman, Morris, and Kaplan. She worked at Portland State University as coordinator of student legal and mediation services from 2004 to 2006 before being appointed as a circuit court judge. She's a past recipient of the Multnomah Bar Association's Award of Merit and the Oregon State Bar's Diversity and Inclusion Award.
Some Oregon lawmakers are determined to make a big push for a program to cap carbon emissions during the 2018 legislative session next month. KBOO's Zelos Marchant has more.
Will 2018 be the year Oregon legislators set a cap on carbon emissions? State lawmakers have been working out the details of a cap-and-trade program and expect to introduce a draft bill on January 8th, 1 month before this year's session. The aim is to reduce the carbon emissions cap each year and help Oregon reach its goal of emissions that are 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. Senator Michael Dimbrough, one of the bill's chief architects, says recent changes will ensure that rural Oregonians see the benefits of revenue generated by the program.
Rural Oregon contains the people that are already most affected by climate change and will be increasingly so. People who are dependent on natural resources, timber, agriculture, fisheries, etc., where we're already seeing substantial changes due to climate change.
He says funds would first go to businesses affected by the policy change. After that, 60% of revenue would go to communities most affected by climate change, 20% to carbon sequestration projects, and the remaining 20% to projects that decrease greenhouse gas emissions. Opponents of the bill have said they see it as a tax on businesses. Dimbrough says companies are able to trade their emission allowances if they get ahead of the curve, which would incentivize investment in energy-efficient technologies. He says that makes this policy more flexible than a simple carbon tax. But he acknowledges it could negatively affect some businesses, so the bill includes a fund for displaced workers.
We want to make sure that we set aside resources that will provide supports for those workers while they're going through retraining in newer, cleaner kinds of industries.
Dimbrough notes cap and trade hasn't severely hurt businesses in other countries or in California, which has the only such program in the nation. He adds there's a sense of urgency to act on climate change as soon as possible.
It's clear to all of us that changes that we need are not going to come from Washington, D.C. They're going to have to come from the states. They're going to have to come from the regions. They're going to have to come from states working together with our partners to the north in Canada. And together, we can make a real difference.
Dimbrough hopes the bill will become a model for other states facing the same issues. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and for the KBOO Evening News, I'm Zelos Marchant.
A cold front labeled as a bomb cyclone is expected to hit the East Coast later this week. The winter hurricane is projected to lay heavy snow and hard winds in states from Georgia to Maine. Some locations are predicted to have up to 12 inches of snow. The most extreme blizzard conditions will occur over the ocean. The storm is predicted to break some records and may be one of the largest East Coast blizzards in decades.
And now we hear from our friends at Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For Michel Drapier, owner of a historic vineyard in France, champagne is not just a drink, it's a legacy.
Today, I'm the seventh generation of the same family producing champagne.
He says global warming is changing champagne production in both good and bad ways. Warmer temperatures can help grapes thrive, but extreme weather, like heavy rain and hail, can threaten crops. Drapier is confident that his business can adapt by managing pests and disease and by storing reserves of wine that can be bottled and sold in years when the harvest suffers. But he realizes that climate change is affecting the world far beyond his vineyard, so he's taking action to address the root cause.
We're proud to be the first champagne house to be carbon neutral.
the business produces nearly half of its electricity from rooftop solar and has aggressively reduced fuel consumption. To offset its remaining carbon emissions, Drapier has invested in a wind turbine project in India.
It's not for us. It's for the whole population of our world. And it's for the next generation.
Cheers to that. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
It's a sad day for tacos in Portland. After many rumors flooded the city about a possible closure, the Oregonian reports that the original Taco House, the nearly 60-year-old family-style Mexican restaurant chain, has closed close of its remaining locations over last weekend. The closure comes as a surprise to customers, staff, and vendors. The original Taco House was opened by a longtime local restaurant-owning family, the Waddles, back in 1960. Recently, the restaurant chain, which is still family-owned, contracted from 5 metro area locations down to just 2, one on Northeast 82nd Avenue, the other on Southeast Powell Boulevard. According to a statement posted in The Door, both locations are now closed. The restaurant, known for its big bowls of rice, beans, and melted cheese, was Portland's longest-running Mexican restaurant. A statement from grandson Jeff Waddle, taped to The Doors, read, "We are closing our doors to both of our original Taco House restaurants tomorrow, December 31st, 2017. We sincerely thank and appreciate all of our longtime dedicated customers, our tremendous vendors, and all of the loyal support from our wonderful employees that we have been blessed with for so many years. Our Waddles family business began in 1945, built by my grandparents' dreams, hard work, and extreme sacrifices, and continued on with many fun, prosperous years of giving sincere thanks to my parents and two brothers for their passion and devoted efforts that made it possible for our family to successfully serve our quality original tacos house foods to 4 family generations of customers. This final chapter comes as a very emotional decision. There are simply no Waddle left to greet our customers with the warm, sincere welcomeness that has been in our family's most essential ingredient since the beginning of our time."
Congress has approved funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP, for the next 3 months, but has yet to reach a deal for the long term. Nearly 100,000 Oregon children rely on the program for coverage. Eric Tegetoff with Oregon News Service has more on this.
A last-minute deal in Congress to provide short-term funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program hasn't done much to alleviate stress for states and parents going into the new year. Known as CHIP, the program helps cover 9 million children nationwide, including nearly 100,000 in Oregon. The congressional deal gave the program funding through March, but no long-term fix for states. Tanya Hunt, head of Children First for Oregon, says working-class families are in a tight bind on top of finding health care, facing rising housing costs, the high expense of child care, and relatively stagnant wages compared with high-income earners.
So that squeeze is already happening for our families. If you add in this impossible expectation that families are going to somehow come up with the full cost of health insurance for their children and themselves, the math just simply won't work.
Hunt says the program also helps stabilize the health market. She says if families wait until children have to go to the emergency room for an ailment and can't afford that visit, the cost falls on taxpayers. The bill has received bipartisan support since it was authored in 1997 by Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch. Hunt says the program is popular across the country.
It's really a mystery why it continues to suffer from the political gamesmanship in Congress to not receive the long-term funding that states need in order to plan for and implement the program adequately.
Republican and Democratic leaders in Congress have disagreed on how to fund the program. The total cost for CHIP in 2016 was nearly $16 billion, with more than 90% of funds coming from the federal government. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Activist Erica Garner, the eldest daughter of Eric Garner, who died at the hands of police in New York City, died last Saturday after a major heart attack. Garner was 27. A representative of the family announced Wednesday through Garner's Twitter account that the heart attack left her with major brain damage. Ms. Garner has been placed in a medically induced coma last week after an asthma episode precipitated a major heart attack. She was brought to Woodhull Medical and Mental Health Center in Brooklyn, where she passed. Erica Garner became a central figure in the heated conversations about race and the use of force by the police after New York Police Department officer placed her father into a chokehold on Staten Island in 2014 while responding to complaints that he was selling untaxed cigarettes. In a tweet on Saturday, Mayor Bill de Blasio praised Ms. Garner's unshakable sense of justice and passion for humanity. In an interview last month with Benjamin Dixon, the host of a forward-thinking podcast, Ms. Garner spoke about her frustrations and the physical exhaustion of her activism. She said, quote, "I'm struggling right now with stress and everything. This thing, it beats you down. The system beats you down to where you can't win," unquote. Erica Garner had an 8-year-old daughter and a 4-month-old son, whom she named after her father. In addition to her children and her mother, she is also survived by 2 sisters, 2 brothers, and her grandmother.
Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, the longest-serving Senate Republican, announced today that he will retire at the end of 2018 after deflecting requests from Donald Trump for him to seek an 8th term. This paves the way for Mitt Romney, a Trump critic, to run for the seat. Mr. Hatch made his decision public on Tuesday afternoon via a video announcement. He said, quote, "When the president visited Utah last month, he said I was a fighter. I've always been a fighter. I was an amateur boxer in my youth, and I've brought that fighting spirit with me to Washington. But every good fighter knows when to hang up the gloves, and for me, that time is soon approaching." Hatch, 83, who has shown himself to be one of President Trump's most avid loyalists, decided to retire after discussing the matter with family members over the holidays.
And now, it's time for your weekly word riddle. Here's the point puzzle.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I left you with a 2-week challenge for the new year.
I am unwritten. Undefined. I'm just beginning. The pen's in my hand. Ending.
I'm looking for 3 classic works of literature whose titles contain numbers. Add those numbers together to get 2018. So again, I'm looking for 3 classics. Each of them has a number in its title. Add the 3 numbers together to get 2018. There are probably multiple answers to this question, but so far, all the answers that I've received are the same as the one I came up with. When you have an answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you listen to the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select 1 winner from among any answers received by this Saturday, that's Saturday, January 6th. If you'd like to see this puzzle written, go to the Point Puzzle page of the KPOV website.
I'm a man with a mission. With 3 additions in, I'm giving you a long look. Every day, every day, every day, every day I write the book.
Now's the time for us to say Happy New Year, Happy New Year.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of January 1st. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Legislation championed by a U.S. Oregon congressman has passed the House and Senate. If enacted, it's set to benefit 3 tribes. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
The Western Oregon Tribal Fairness Act cedes more than 17,000 acres of federal land to the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Indians. Another 14,000 acres goes to the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. It gives both tribes a land base since they regained federal recognition in the 1980s. As for the Coquille tribe, the act restores governance of their tribal forest, effectively decoupling them from federal land management rules. Mark Johnston is executive director of the Coquille tribe. He says they've managed their 5,400-acre forest efficiently, despite the unique legal burden put on them in 1996.
And for the Coquille, we've been certified by Forest Stewardship Council, FSC, for a number of years. And you'll take a look at our land, and we truly believe in a balance between conservation and sustainable harvest.
The bill now heads to President Trump's desk. Tribal officials hope he'll sign off on it. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Dozens of cold weather records were tied or broken over much of the plains over the weekend. All of South Dakota's reservations are being impacted by cold air temperatures and dangerous wind chill. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt has more.
At least a half dozen tribal schools in South Dakota closed for the day because of the dangerous cold. One school, Teos Bates Hopa, in north-central South Dakota, stayed closed because of heating issues in the building. Matthew Dukes with the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls says there's a bit of a warming trend coming, but it's pretty short-lived.
The main brunt of the cold weather actually came through the area over this weekend. Now, as we move through the rest of this week and into next weekend, this is just kind of a glancing blow of a little bit of cold air that's left up to our north. It won't nearly be as cold as what we saw here over the New Year's holiday weekend. Temperatures from Tuesday through Friday will only average into the single digits over the eastern half of the state to perhaps even the teens and some 20s over the western half of the state through Friday.
Aberdeen in northeast South Dakota broke a 99-year-old record low on New Year's Day with a reading of 32 degrees below zero. Wind chills bottomed out at minus 50 in some locations. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
A weather emergency has been issued by the Blackfeet Nation in Montana. On Monday night, the tribe activated its emergency plan for winter storms due to a blizzard. The National Weather Service has issued a blizzard warning. An incident command center has been set up at tribal headquarters in Browning. Tribal offices are closed and residents are asked to seek shelter and only travel for emergencies. The Mashpee Wampanoag tribe has laid off some employees, the Cape Cod Times reports. A letter to workers cites reasons as funding and litigation involving the tribe's effort to build a casino. The Massachusetts tribe received federal recognition status in 2007 and has since beefed up efforts to build a resort casino in the city of Taunton. The tribe is reportedly in hundreds of millions of dollars in debt. The layoffs were recently issued with official termination on January 12th. Tribal leaders have long maintained the casino would provide jobs and boost the economy. A Superior Court judge rejected part of the Scaticook Nation's lawsuit seeking millions of dollars from Connecticut for land the tribe claims was taken more than 200 years ago. The Hartford Current reports last week's decision included two documents from the 1700s, which show use and not ownership. Other parts of the lawsuit remain, including mortgage claims. The tribe is seeking more than $600 million for 2,000 acres it says the state took without compensation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down. When you're strange, faces come out of the rain. When you're strange.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX with their annual Trans Arts Showcase. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, cloudy with lows of 35. Tomorrow is partially cloudy with a high of 44. Today in history, in 1981, the Yorkshire Ripper is finally caught by British police, ending one of the largest manhunts in history. The quote of the day is from Leonard Nimoy in his role as Spock. He said, "Incredible critical moments, men sometimes see exactly what they wish to see."
When you're strange, faces.
After having brought to justice some of those who committed war crimes in the former Yugoslavia during the 1990s, the International Criminal Tribunal is shutting down. Over the last several decades, war crimes have been committed in many other parts of the world, like Iraq and Syria. War criminals have had some reasons to be afraid of international justice, but not enough to make them very afraid or more honest. The effort to instate a global system of justice which could keep war criminals from escape is one path to what can be achieved by nation states acting together. But the refusal of other countries to join the effort, namely China and the United States, shows how much of an effort can be undermined. Now with the closure of the ICT, world leaders are looking for its replacement. Currently, there is the International Criminal Court, but it also requires a large number of participatory states. The treaty to establish the court was adopted by 120 states back in July of 1998. and its creation since then has been slow. It took 4 years to achieve ratification by half the countries in 2002 in order to legitimize the court. Since then, its achievements have been low, with 31 arrest warrants and only 25 cases appearing before the court, from which judges have issued verdicts in just 6 of those cases. Only 9 people have been convicted and 1 acquitted. A common accusation against the ICC is that it may be better named the African Criminal Court, as it's been alleged to be used larger by former colonial powers from Europe to punish a single continent and ignore many other conflicts. There have been terrible genocides and crimes against humanity in Africa, but the country has a record of active participation in and support for the ICC. Of 123 countries who are involved with the International Criminal Court, 33 are African states.
Large protests broke out in cities across Iran last week. The protests began as a response to soaring prices, but have evolved into a general outcry against clerical rule and government policies. According to Tehran's Deputy Government General for Security Affairs, who spoke with the Iranian Labor News Agency, a small number of people who were arrested in the capital of Tehran were among a group of 50 who were gathered in a city square.
According to Iranian state television and the ABC News, protests against Iran continued, leading to one of the most violent nights as armed protesters attempted to overrun military bases and police stations before security forces repelled them, killing 10 people. The demonstrations were the largest to strike Iran since the disputed 2009 presidential election and has seen 5 days of unrest across the country. Death toll is at 13 as of press time, including the slaying of a police officer. The protests began Thursday in Mashhad over Iran's brittle economy, and a jump in food prices have expanded to several cities, with some protesters chanting against the government and the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
Israel's parliament passed a law which will require a supermajority to relinquish control over any part of Jerusalem. It's a move that might hamstring the city's division in future peace deals. The amendment keeps the government from ceding Israeli sovereignty over any part of Jerusalem without direct approval from at least 80 of the legislature's 120 members, but the law itself can be overruled with a majority vote, in effect rendering it mostly symbolic. The law also allows the government to remove outlying Palestinian areas from the city, a move promoted by hardliners to protect Jerusalem's Jewish majority. These neighborhoods would be turned into separate municipalities under Israeli control. Israel claims all of Jerusalem as its capital, but the Palestinians want East Jerusalem to be the capital of their future state. Israel captured East Jerusalem in the 1967 war and then annexed it in a move that has been criticized internationally. Tensions escalated recently after the Trump administration declared Jerusalem to be Israel's capital last month, which broke decades of U.S. policy, including an international consensus that the city's status should be decided in peace negotiations.
Last year saw historic firsts coast to coast and the rise of activist heroes. Our friends at Making Contact looked at 2017's unsung heroes in this part one of this feature.
You know, I feel so sorry for Willie. I hate to see any baseball player having troubles, because that's a great sport for my people. That is the only sport in the world where a Negro can shake a stick at a white man and won't start no riot. And you heard what Bobby Kennedy said about 8 weeks ago. He said, 30 years from this year, a Negro can become president. So treat me right, or I'll get in there and raise taxes on you. I mean, now don't get me wrong. I wouldn't mind paying my income tax if I knew it was going to a friendly country.
That was comedian and civil rights activist Dick Gregory in his first ever national TV appearance on ABC back in 1961. Gregory passed away this year, leaving more than half a century of art and cutting commentary as his legacy. But he's only one of thousands of activists, organizers, and local social justice leaders who died in 2017. Many of them didn't make the headlines. I'm Andrew Stelzer. This week on Making Contact, we bring you some of the voices and stories of the year's fallen heroes.
I'm Jackie Cabasso. I'm the executive director of Western States Legal Foundation, a 35-year-old nuclear disarmament advocacy group. Sumitaro Taniguchi was a survivor of the U.S. atomic bombing of Nagasaki. He was 16 years old when, and about a mile away from the hypocenter of the atomic bomb, he was actually a mailman.
突然、背後から虹のような光が目に映り。
Suddenly, from behind me, there came a rainbow of light, and I was blown over and crushed into the road by the ferocious force of the blast. When at length I attempted to stand, I discovered that the skin on my left arm was hanging loose like a dirty rag from my shoulder right down to my fingers. I touched my back and found that my clothes were no longer there, and my skin came away slimy on my hands.
He was injured very, very severely. His back was essentially burned off, and he spent 2 or 3 years in the hospital on his stomach.
Even today, you can still see my heart beating between my ribs, because it's as though my chest has been scooped out. I have been told that my lung capacity is almost half that of a healthy person.
Taniguchi was a founder of Hidankyo, which was the movement of atomic bomb survivors who have become known around the world for their plea that what happened to us is so terrible it can never be allowed to happen again, and that nuclear weapons and human beings are not compatible. Photographs of his burned back, bright red burned back, became kind of iconic.
Nuclear weapons are cruel and inhumane. There is overwhelming international support for their abolition. I pledge before all those who desire peace to inherit the wishes of all my companions who have passed away over the past 70 years, and that as a living witness of war and the atomic bomb, that I will continue to convey the truth of the atomic bombing throughout the world for as long as I live, so that we may realize a peaceful world without war or nuclear weapons.
He and the other survivors who have gone public with their stories actually literally gave their lives for the elimination of nuclear weapons, because every time they tell those stories, they have to relive the unbearable experience of hell on Earth. So it was impossible to see him, talk to him, interact with him, and not be aware of the devastating effects of the atomic bomb that he had survived and that he devoted his life to working to eliminate so that it would never happen to anybody else.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman and Kyle Carezzi. Special thanks to RadioProject.org, Native Voice One, and the Public News Service. The producer is Zelos Marchant. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seywe. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jasmine.
And I'm Kyle. And coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland. At 9, it's The Politics of Living, the author of Among the Living and the Dead, Three Generations of Exile Along the War Roads of Europe. Thoughts on gun violence and shooting massacres, March Every Day, inspired by the women's and science marches, and more. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views from cycling in Portland and beyond. KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A group of Portlanders is hoping to draw attention to racial injustice and police violence in the Portland area with a bold public project. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with some of them last week. A longer version of this interview is available at kboo.fm.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. I'm Sam Bowman. On December 9th, the group Portland Equity in Action held an auction in Northeast Portland to raise money for the Stolen Angels PDX billboard project. I was joined in the studio last week by four members of Portland Equity in Action: Britton Washington, Olivia Stone, Victoria Ruffin, and Courtney Santoro, as well as Alicia Johnson, the mother of Terrell Johnson, who was shot by Portland police in May of last year. We talked about the billboard project and how they hope it can address problems of racial inequality and police brutality in the Portland area. The first voice you'll hear is the group's lead organizer, Britton Washington.
We kind of formed out of like a discussion group almost that was a now kind of disbanded meeting, twice a month meeting for people of color. And that was back in, I think maybe the end of May was the first time we kind of got organized, because out of that kind of community meetups, we had work groups. And so we all met through, we were in the racial equity work group. And so at the end of May, I think, is when we kind of formed as, we can actually be doing work mm-hmm. without these community meetups. Yeah, I guess it was probably within a month we were Portland Equity in Action and had our own meetings and plans. And yeah, we did a sticker campaign up on Mississippi on July 8th, which is, we did it the morning of the Mississippi Street Fair, so once a year, and we plastered stickers all over that said, let's talk about Quanis Hayes and let's talk about Terrell Johnson.
Did you get any specific reaction to those stickers?
Well, nobody knew that, like, we had done it, but I still see pictures online, like, randomly. People will, you know, there's still a few up on Mississippi, you can see them, so people will see them and maybe snap a picture of them and mm-hmm. post them and stuff, but it was never, we never broadcasted it. It was all very undercover.
And it was kind of like the first step towards doing something really tangible.
That's the voice of Olivia Stone, a member of Portland Equity in Action.
And the work groups that we had been a part of, I think the folks that ended up in Portland Equity in Action were those who in the work groups were feeling really kind of frustrated about not having anything actionable to work towards. We were coming together month after month. I heard about the work group through Britton and came to check it out, but there wasn't any planning or any next steps. And there was a group of us that were feeling frustrated with that. You know, we were talking about the rampant complacency with white supremacy in the city, and here we are just kind of talking about it and then walking away, going back home to our normal routines. So we wanted to kind of branch out from that group, put together a plan of action, and really start doing things and confronting people in the city. And the sticker campaign was kind of our way of proving to ourselves that we could actually organize and do something. And then from there, we kind of moved into the billboard campaign after Britton got in touch with some of the moms.
I suppose that's a good time to talk to you, Alicia. How did you become involved with this project?
My son, Terrell Johnson, was murdered by the police on May 10th, 2017. And Teresa was doing an art project. Do you remember what that was?
It was the Stolen Angels exhibit at the Williamson Night Gallery.
So I had gotten in contact with her, and she invited me to bring some art in and pictures of Terrell and explained to me what the whole entire exhibit was. And so I went to that and was involved with that. And then that's when I met Britton, and she told me that they were working on some stuff and you know, if I wanted to get in touch, to get in touch. So I did. And then, and that's when I first found out about the Stolen Angels project and the Billboard project.
And if you want, can you talk a little bit about Terrell, just who he was?
Terrell, he was wonderful. He was amazing. He was very personable. Everybody that knew him loved him. He was, you know, really down to earth and really personable. He would talk to people like a lot wouldn't. We did a lot of community service and feeding the homeless, and he did that like his whole life. And he would sit and talk. Like when we'd be feeding the homeless, he'd feed for a while, and then he'd just sit and talk with the people. And afterwards, they'd always come up to me and be like, "Oh, you just have such a great son. Like I've never been talked to in such a personable way." And all his friends felt the same way about him. He just was the best person to get in touch with whenever you needed somebody to actually listen and hear what you had to say and really, you know, just really connect with. He was just really easy to connect with. He was just so personable and great sense of humor, great smile. You know, always playing and dancing and singing and hanging out. So yeah, he was great that way.
So the Billboard project coming up, where did the idea for that come from?
It was actually, I think so. July 8th was the street fair, and we did the sticker campaign, and that was kind of when we realized that our efforts, I think collectively, we were interested in doing visual campaigns on an equitable level, which we consider to be a street level, to kind of put these issues in people's faces so you can't ignore them, you can't walk past it, you can't avoid them or escape them.
Regarding the project, again, I saw on the project website one of the main goals is to sort of draw attention to sort of racial disparities as well in criminal justice enforcement in Oregon. And could you talk about that aspect of the project a little bit? That seems to kind of go back to the original discussion group.
Yeah. It goes kind of to your awareness.
That's the voice of Portland Equity in Action member Victoria Ruffin.
Because here in Portland, it's not talked about, it's not addressed. People of color coming together to talk about it is something that happens, but then it stays kind of in this current undercurrent, kind of within folks who already know, preaching to the choir, essentially. But to have come together and to be able to bring it to this sort of platform will be amazing, because people need to talk about this. People need to understand, especially here. This is such a...
Well, yeah, I mean...
The history of this town, yeah. And
well, Portland, you know, is, what, 20% whiter than any other, like, major city in the country. And Oregon locks up people of color and black people at higher rates than any other state. And we have the least people of color here. And the most people of color being finding themselves within the criminal justice system. And of those people, I mean, we also have such, like, we're surrounded by, you know, white supremacist groups and this very strong belief and urge around Portland, outside of Portland, you know, of people who don't understand that and who feel like people of color and black people are criminals and are, you know, are people who need to be maintained, for lack of a better word. And it's dangerous. And this is what leads to people like Terrell not being here with us anymore, not having committed a crime, you know, and he's dead, and there nobody found anything wrong with that, and so yeah, I think, I mean, Portland is supposed to be such a progressive place and town and whatever, but we're so progressive on everything except for racial equity, honestly. Like, I mean, people can live here their entire lives and be, you know, they can compost and they can recycle and they can be environmental advocates and animal advocates and anti-capitalists or whatever they want to be, and at the same time ask you what the need is to advocate for racial equity and equality, and what, well, we don't have a problem with that here, and whatever.
Such staunch cognitive dissonance in Portland, especially around healing and like all the things you mentioned, because this city is so centered in that, let's heal or let's have some growth or there's change, be progressive, but there's such a massive almost cancer like that undercurrently runs through this city, and this is awareness. Yeah.
It's just, I mean, I think that people of color just have such, we've just been so like invisible here for so long, and there's not been enough of us really to warrant importance, so it kind of just, There are issues that affect us that don't matter, and people don't have to know that it matters like you would in a larger city with greater diversity, and people are allowed to ignore it for those reasons and to pretend like it's not happening or it's not real here specifically. So that's where we come in, I think, and we are not gonna let that don't happen anymore.
Yeah.
We're gonna make you stop ignoring it. So sorry.
And on a positive note, like, we're out here too. Mm-hmm. Like, we are. Mm-hmm. We're out here and we're doing things, and people can see that when they see these poster boards and see the representation, and that comes from like Portland's, like, people of color that have been here, that live here. The billboards. I speak on this as a transplant. That's my perspective and all this, because that's a thing. Like, being a person of color who is a transplant here and trying to be in connection somehow to other people of color here without kind of building almost a wall around the actual community and actual people who are affected. And so to kind of bridge that gap via a visualization project that focuses on such a, like, it's like popping a zit. Just one of many.
Yeah.
Feel it now.
What are the names of everybody?
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, so it's called the Stolen Angels PDX Billboard Project. We got that name because from the Don't Shoot exhibit that they ran in the summer, so Stolen Angels, exhibition that ran at the Williamson Night Gallery that Elisa mentioned earlier. So we are focusing on five young men and working with their families. So Terrell Johnson, who is Alicia's son, we just mentioned him, and then Quanis Hayes, who was also killed this year, February, and Christopher Kalonji and Bodie Phelps, who were both killed by police last year in 2016, and Larnell Bruce, who is the only one of our Stolen Angels who wasn't murdered by police, but he was murdered by this couple who identify as white supremacists. They ran him down in cold blood in their Jeep. So that was, yeah. That was back in August of 2016. So. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, the Stolen Angels started with the Don't Shoot gallery.
Yeah, so they were all five of them were featured in the gallery. There were many other people featured in that exhibit, but we're just wanted to focus on very recent ones locally. So in the last 2 years, these five were killed in what we see as racially motivated police brutality and and white supremacy. So that's where we got permission to use that name from Teresa because they were all featured in that exhibit and so the Billboard Project could be a sort of like continuation of the exhibit.
Okay.
In a way.
In general terms, how did the auction go?
It was very successful.
Yeah.
Very good. Yes. Yeah.
Great.
It was a great, great outcome. It was better than we even, I think, expected it to be.
Anything else you want to say?
Or? One thing I just, that really gets me from, you know, talking and listening to a lot of stuff is unfortunately in Portland, or probably a lot of places, but in Portland, you know, not only do you have to deal with and worry about white supremacist groups when you're black, but you also have to worry about the cops.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman. In this piece, I spoke to members of Portland Equity in Action, including their lead organizer, Britton Washington, and members Olivia Stone, Courtney Santoro, and Victoria Ruffin, as well as Alicia Johnson.
And the time is 5:56, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next is Transpositive PDX for their annual Trans Arts Showcase. So stay tuned, KBOO.
Turn in Friday nights from 6 to 7 p.m. for Bread and Roses. This collective has been on air since 1978, making it the longest-running feminist news and public affairs radio show in the country. You can find Bread and Roses on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/breadandroses, or on Facebook at KBOO Bread and Roses Radio. We hope you tune in.
Tuesday nights on KBOO, it's Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush.
With DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid.
10 p.m. to midnight.
2 hours of global bass featuring Bhangra, Bollywood,
and the urban sounds of the global diaspora. You're done north!
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive. It is time for our Trans Arts Showcase. We are so excited. So here in studio tonight, we have got Trans Pose and Key of Q. And we have Aiden Vargas. We've got Nicolette Sandra James. We have Kira. Possibly Zealous will be joining us. We have Rad from the Queer Tattoo Alliance. It's going to be a whole show of just really amazing showcasing of trans artists and trans arts. But before we do, let's go around and introduce everyone who's in the collective, starting stage right.
Hi, I'm Guinevere.
And I'm Jean Bryant.
Hello, I'm Aiden.
I'm Nicolette.
My name's Kara Chafee.
Great. So we're going to go ahead and get started. If someone could bring in the, if somebody could let the Transpose know, go to the door and let Transpose know that they can come in. Transpose is a transgender choir, and they also have a smaller choir called Key of Q, and they're going to be having a concert here in Portland on
in January, which they will tell you all about. And as they're coming into studio, we're just going to get set up in here. This is a live show. We're doing a whole choir, so this is going to be really exciting. The whole idea of Trans Art Showcase is to highlight some of the really amazing trans artists who are living and performing here in Nashville, in Portland, Oregon. We have an amazing city full of really amazing artists who are trans and gender fluid and gender non-binary, and we have Transpose in studio, so we're going to go ahead and let them get started.
I messed up tonight. I lost another fight. I still mess up, but I'll just start again. I keep falling down. I keep on hitting the ground. I